Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of PAS FML, the only podcast run by an actual, real-life, current PA student. That's me. I'm your host, Pia K, and on today's episode, I am going to be talking all about my current rotation, which is the third rotation that I've been on, and it is in urgent care slash kind of primary care. And the nice thing about urgent care is that turns out, despite its name of urgent, it's actually a little more chill than my previous two rotations. So my first rotation was in the ED, and my second rotation was on a hospitalist team doing inpatient medicine in a big hospital. So if you haven't checked those out yet, please go and do so, because I had a ton of information to share. But again, turns out urgent care, not as complicated. So I actually have some time on this episode to get into some of the clinical medicine and get in some sweet, sweet panic studying for us. And I'm really glad that I've got some time to do some panic studying, because I haven't done much studying, like, at all. And the scary thing is that next week, my classmates and I are all heading back to campus for the first time since we left for clinical rotations months ago now. And literally the first day back, we are taking a practice boards exam. It's called the PACRAT, and I don't know how to spell it. I just know that I'm taking it, and it's about a 3.5-hour test, and supposedly somewhere in the world there's some sort of conversion score where you can figure out if you would actually pass the real boards exam. So that's going on, and like I said, I've not studied, so let's do some panic studying. And I thought this would be a good time to talk about some of the really common things that I saw in the more on the primary care side of this clinical rotation that I've been on. So let's get going. Okay, so I am actually a huge nerd, but I am a really big fan of analogies and visualizations. So if you listen to my earlier podcast, I talked, I compared the ED to being playing like dominoes, meaning you get your patient and you have to set them up for something. Either you do a treatment for them to see how it turns out, or you grab some labs or imaging. But you basically, with each patient that you get, you've got these little dominoes that you set up, and you just kind of gently nudge them forward and, you know, let the lab do its work, or let the imaging folks do their work, or let the IV fluid do its work and see what happens. So you just kind of set these dominoes up and you just give them a little plink, and they go one by one down the line. And at the end of the game, you've either got a treatment plan or you fixed your patient. So that's my dominoes analogy for how the ED functions. And then on my second rotation, which was hospital medicine, inpatient hospital medicine, that was less fun. It didn't feel like a game at all. It actually felt like It actually felt like trying to spin a whole bunch of plates on like those long, tall rod things. And basically your whole day was spent just trying not to drop all the various plates that your various patients were making you carry. And a lot of those plates, maybe we caused some of the extra plates, meaning the patient came in for kidney problems, and so you gave them a whole bunch of fluids, but now all of a sudden you come in the next day and damn it, now you're drowning their lungs in the fluids that you gave them to fix their AKI. So sometimes we cause the spinning plates, and other times you come in and all of a sudden now the patient has a bumped troponin. Well, like, what the hell happened there? So now you're following serial troponins. So I felt like in the hospital, it was just so precarious that I was constantly having to monitor vitals and lab values and just anything in general with my patients, because it felt like I was spinning plates for every single patient, and every single patient I felt like had like 9 or 10 plates going on at one time. And at any point, any one of them could topple over and crash and bust all over my feet, and I would be a bad provider. So that was the beauty of internal medicine, not to scare anybody who's not yet done their clinical rotation. So for what it's worth, go check out my episode on that if you care to have some sort of idea about what's coming at you. So that brings me to my third one, which is, again, the urgent care. And the one that I'm at actually does urgent care and like kind of primary care too, actually. Just a quick note on the personal one that I'm at. It is super small. They only ever have one provider on, whether it's the PA, and that's the main person that I'm following. They have a handful of MDs and a DO and like two family nurse practitioners, FNPs. So there's only ever one of them on at a time. We only have two exam rooms, and we don't even have any MAs. So I have, for 6 weeks now, or almost 6 weeks, taken every single blood pressure, done every temperature, done all the O2 and the heart rates. And that's been great because I can actually take somebody's blood pressure now, which I, despite the fact that my program really did try its best to teach me how to do a manual blood pressure, I was pretty much just faking it until I made it. So maybe that's a success story that I can talk about now. I actually know how to take somebody's blood pressure manually, and I was totally faking it probably the first week that I was here. I mean, I was guessing. I mean, don't get me wrong. It's not like I was just making up random numbers, but I was like, maybe that was it, you know, give or take 2 or 4 points kind of thing. Anyway, I'm really good at it now. So, thank you for not having any MAs, because now I'm a better clinician because of that. So that's my clinic. And also the one last thing I'll say about my clinic is that it's neat because we are located in this super tropical, lush climate where people spend all the time in the water. And because of that, I have actually seen some of the things that I only read about, like in the HENT module, for instance, where I was like, I'm never going to see that thing, like an ear growth in the ear canal caused by wind from surfers. Yeah, okay, you know, out my brain, not putting it in my brain. And then turns out I get here and it's actually super common, and like people know that they have it, and they're like, oh yeah, that's my exostosis. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I even had one guy who had it like drilled out, because if you recall, maybe you will, maybe you won't, but it's a bone growth. So it's not like it goes down, but exostosis is like a bone growth, and it's basically your body trying to protect your ear canal from all the wind and water, and cold water specifically. So your body gets smart and tries to lay down more bone inside your ear so that you don't cause it harm. So that's been neat because I've seen some tropical things like that. So I actually will spend some time getting into a handful of those tropical things at the end of this, but I really, really wanted to talk about some of the main, like three or four main things that I've seen while I've been on rotation here. But we're going to get to sweet, sweet panic studying in a minute. I think I really only have one clinical pearl to give about the urgent care. I could say that, like, for instance, I talked to some of my classmates, and some of them have already done like half of their digital rectal exams and pelvic exams, and it was because they did urgent care. Well, that wasn't me, but I did more of my DREs in my ED experience. So, you know, everybody's experience is obviously going to be a little bit different here. Again, for the most part, my patients, at least, have come through the door, and I can pretty much put them in one of two categories. Either they are true, legitimate, urgent care patients, meaning they're basically just coming in for like an acute viral issue or bacterial issue, right? Like a URI, essentially. This is the time of the year that everything's going around. People either have their flu shots or they don't. So they're either coming in with the flu or they're coming in with a URI or some strep throat kind of goodness. These people are either true urgent care people or, and I didn't know that this was a second option until I was just really feeling overwhelmed with one particular patient who came in one day. And my preceptor, who is a PA, a very wise PA, wisely told me, oh, so you're feeling overwhelmed with the seven things that this chronically ill patient brought in for you to deal with today? Yes, of course you are. That's because they are better served by an internal medicine provider. And that just clicked for me. It made me feel less of a failure because I was really feeling totally inadequate and that I wasn't helping this patient at all because they had seven problems that they were coming in with, long-standing problems and vague symptoms going on. I'm like, yeah, I wish I could tell you why your eye got puffy after you took a bath yesterday. I'm not quite sure what to tell you about that. I mean, I suppose I could have just said you're a hypochondriac, but that's not helpful. The difference between a true urgent care patient and then these patients, again, who are probably are better served through legitimate internal medicine providers because they only come in when they've got five things on a list because they don't want to, quote, waste the visit. Literally, I had somebody tell me that. And we could talk all day. And in fact, I could probably talk for 2 days on the structure of our healthcare system such that people either don't have access to a legitimate like internal medicine primary care provider. Again, that's a topic for another day. So the reality is that sometimes these people come in and they are just time consuming because of the either amount of concerns that they have or the complexity of concerns that they have. And I wish I could give a better pearl on how to best deal with that kind of presentation, but I myself don't have a good way to deal with it. My preceptor is really nice in that he's never told me that I need to speed up on seeing the patients. And he's never gotten upset with me for spending 55 minutes digging through somebody's intense, complex history. So I've been lucky, but I know that that's not a thing in the real world. Maybe he's letting me make these mistakes now because I'm kind of coming to the conclusion that I know that I can't do that with every patient. And I actually just read an article this morning that was delivered to my Medscape inbox or my inbox by Medscape. And it said something along the lines of, it's best to validate that these people come in with literally a list of issues. And if you can, try to cut them off at the pass and say, well, give me a brief overview about the things that are concerning you. I'm going to try my absolute best to get to all of them today. But just in case we don't, do you have time to come back and see me next week or in a couple days? When can I get you back in here to split this up? You know, that way so that you're validating the patient and you're not interrupting them or kind of hand-waving off some of these concerns of theirs because, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes vague symptoms are cause for concern. And so just because it's vague doesn't mean that you don't talk about it. So I need to do a better job of trying to incorporate some of those recommendations into dealing with some of these more long-winded or complex patients. For now, I've just been spending an hour with these guys kind of shrugging my shoulders. And sometimes we draw labs and sometimes I refer them back to the neurologist or to their GI person. Or actually a lot of times we say, well, why don't we wait on it for a minute and see what happens in another 2-3 days or even a week. So that's really the only like behind the scenes pearl that I can give you. Otherwise, it's primary care medicine and the red bound book, the super mini primary care book has been super helpful. It fits in your pocket and it's like got a hardcover and it's red and they change it every few years when they update it. So it's now it's red. It used to be like, I don't know, orange or something like that. And that's been fantastic. And I've found a ton of my information that I've needed to in there. Plus, pro tip, because it's hardbound, you can write on it. So that was really helpful as well. So those are my only two tips. Get that book. I'm going to have to look up the name for you. And sometimes your urgent care patients are actually going to be internal medicine patients, but you have to talk to them anyway. See if you can cut them off at the pass and try to schedule another appointment with them in a week or two. All right. So that's my behind the care of urgent care stuff. Let's get into some sweet, sweet panic studying. Okay, real quick before we do the sweet, sweet panic studying, the name of the little book that I was just talking about is put out by the people who go by Pocket Notebook, and it's called Pocket Primary Care. This one is the second edition, and it's done by the Massachusetts General Hospital people. So you can get it on Amazon, and it's amazing. And I looked at the reviews yesterday, and apparently people hated it when it first came out because they said that the pages were, like, didn't fit in the spiral ring binder or whatever, but mine's perfect. So it's awesome. Okay, let's do some studying. So just to set the stage, here are the top 10 most common things that came through my urgent care / needing primary care help with. And three of them are what we're going to panic study with. So here we go. Number one most complaint was a cough. And it's just that time of the year. It's what, like late November, early December? People are getting sick. People are coming in with coughs. And out of all the people who came in with their various lengths of cough, literally any time from this cough started yesterday to I've had this cough for 2 weeks, I only had one patient who had confirmed pneumonia. There were a handful of people who they had had symptoms for long enough, and the cough was dry enough and it came on suddenly enough that we called it a bronchitis, but pretty much everybody else just had a URI going on. So anyway, couple of mini pearls there about cough. So number one complaint, cough. Number two, hypertension. Number three, hyperlipidemia. And those are actually two of the three things that we're going to get a little bit weedsy with here in just a moment. Number four, low back pain. Oh God, this is such a hard diagnosis. And I talked a lot about it in my emergency department rotation because a ton of people came in for it in the ED as well. So take a listen there. I had some other pearls to go through. Number five, UTI. So cystitis, people having burning, basically a whole bunch of women, it burned when they peed. Did a whole bunch of UA dipsticks for these gals. Basically gave them either Cipro or Bactrim, and as well as told them to either pick up some Azo, or actually wrote them a prescription for Pyridium, which is just prescription strength, Azo. All right, UTI. After that, pharyngitis. So people coming in with sore throats. And we did a handful of, a handful of rapid strep tests, and only a few of them came back positive. But pretty much that's going to be your CENTAUR criteria. So we'll get to that in a quick bit as well. Actually had a lot of people come in with anxiety issues, which I definitely had a podcast all about that. So take care of yourself. I hope you're doing well. We love you, all of you. And then let's see, cellulitis and rash, random rashes. Again, I'm in a tropical climate here. People wearing a ton of bathing suits and getting a whole bunch of rashes all up in, their lady and man bit parts. Fun. And then rounding out the list, at the number 10 spot was diabetes type 2. So the three things we're going to go in depth here are hypertension, hyperlipidemia, and diabetes type 2, because essentially these people would come in and I would take a blood pressure reading, for instance, and I would write it on the page, and then I would, in my head, I would panic because I was like, oh my God, does this qualify for hypertension? Because I had completely forgotten how to formally diagnose these things. So that's primarily what I want to spend time talking about right now. How do you formally diagnose hypertension, hyperlipidemia, diabetes type 2? And then we'll talk about the CENTAUR criteria, because I can never frigging remember that dumb criteria until somebody gave me a quick mnemonic for it. So I'm going to share that with you. And then I also want to talk about two surfer things that I see a lot of out here. So let's see. Let's start with hypertension. Question number one, how do you officially diagnose hypertension? Somebody comes in and what? You take a blood pressure and they're 148 over 84. Great. Do they have hypertension? Well, turns out it depends, because the formal diagnosis for hypertension is that you need at least two elevated blood pressure readings that are spaced at least 1 week apart. So if this is the first time you've seen that person come through the door and they're elevated, you can't say anything. That's great. That is a one-time elevated reading of a blood pressure. So you need at least two elevated blood pressure readings that are spaced at least 1 week apart. And the patient has to have no other identifiable causes, meaning they didn't just come back from the gym or didn't just run to the clinic, or they didn't have 18 cups of coffee 12 seconds ago. So that's the formal diagnosis. And then pro tip, if the systolic versus diastolic, if those end up in two different categories, and we're going to go into those categories right now, but if those two readings are in two different categories, use the higher one. Okay, so how do we classify hypertension? Well, what's normal? What's a normal blood pressure? And keep in mind that there were actually some new updates to how they classified hypertension, I believe just last summer is also like May of 2017. So that's what everybody in clinical practice is using. And I actually am not entirely sure if the boards for 2019 are going to be using these new classifications or not. Actually, I have an email out to one of my professors asking that specific question. So if I get some info, I will update us. But here's the normal blood pressure is systolic of less than 120 and diastolic less than 80. And I say less than because the second you get to 120 or the second you get to 80, officially, you have to call it not normal blood pressure. So this is less than 120, less than 180. Next step is the elevated blood pressure. And so this one is the one that starts at systolic 120 or diastolic, only the systolic. So systolic, the second you hit 120, you're at least into elevated blood pressure. And then wouldn't you know it, you actually still need to have diastolic less than 80 to be considered elevated. Because the second you go, the second you hit 80 on your diastolic, officially, now you're in stage one. So that's a little bit of a discrepancy there, a little kind of a weird thing. So I'm going to say it again. The second you hit 120 on systolic, you can call that patient elevated. Their diastolic still needs to be under 80 though, because if their systolic is say 124 and their diastolic is 82 officially, because the diastolic is over 80, now you have to call them stage one. So just to keep right clear as mud, right? All right. So stage one then is diastolic starting at 80, or you can actually get there if your systolic is over 130. And then stage two starts at systolic of 140 or diastolic at 90. Now, I know I just said a whole bunch of things and you're not looking at any of the words and that's hard. So here, basically, here's what it is. Recap. Normal is under 120 systolic or under 80 diastolic. And then from there, here's the numbers you need to know. Systolic is 120s, 130, 140. Those are your benchmarks. Under 120 is normal. The second you hit systolic 120, you're at elevated. The second you hit systolic at 130, you're stage one. The second you hit systolic at 140, you're stage two. So your systolic numbers, under 120, 120, 130, 140. Done. And there's four stages, so keep that in mind. A little bit different for the diastolic there. The normal and elevated both need to be under 80, but you only have to remember two numbers for diastolic, 80 and 90. So under 80, you're either normal or elevated. The second you hit 80 diastolic, now you're at stage one. The second you hit 90 diastolic, now you're at stage two. So let's put that to a test. Let's say a patient comes in 154 over 92. What are they? 154 over 92. Are they normal, elevated, stage one, or stage two? Yay, they're stage two, right? That was super easy. Okay, here's a harder one. Somebody comes in 126 over 82. 126 over 82. What are they? Because of the diastolic over 80, you have to call them stage one. So a little tricky there because officially you go, oh, systolic is 126. That should only be elevated. But it was hard and I was a jerk because the diastolic was officially over 80. So at 82, now they're at stage one. Okay, let's move on. Just to throw a real quick reminder in here that I know I said that stage two is at 140 systolic and diastolic at 90. Okay, well, what happens if somebody gets like way higher than that? Okay, so the second we hit 140 over 90, officially we're stage two, but what if we're way, way, way high? And recall that there are like emergencies that we can get to if our blood pressure gets too high. Specifically, there's two that we need to remember. There's one thing called hypertensive urgency, and then there's one that's actually called hypertensive crisis or emergency. So they didn't give us any help with trying to make those words sound any different, but officially there's two different kind of urgent things that can go on with our blood pressure here. And the only difference is whether or not the patient is having symptoms. So in hypertensive, how many times am I going to do that? Good Lord. In hypertensive urgency, the numbers to keep in your head are systolic at or greater than 180 or diastolic at or greater than 110. So 180 over 110 is when we start to get really nervous about people, and we're going to put them in one of two categories. We're either going to call them hypertensive urgency or hypertensive emergency. And again, the only difference is what is the patient feeling? So in hypertensive urgency, we've got this increased blood pressure of at least 180 over 1 or 110 for diastolic, but the patient feels fine. They've got no symptoms. And by that, I mean, they have like no apparent end organ damage. They're just sitting in your office. They're sitting in the ED and you're like, oh my God, you're sitting at 195. Are you okay? And they're like, yeah, feel fine. Don't have a headache. I don't have any chest pain. I'm good. So that's hypertensive urgency. Now, what happens if the patient says, oh yeah, I've got chest pain, I've got a headache, or something even worse, they are stroking out, or they're encephalopathic, or let's see what else is on here. Other signs of end organ damage. So we're basically looking for blood pressure of greater than 180 over 110, plus some symptoms and signs of end organ damage. And buzzwords for end organ damage include encephalopathy, nephropathy, aortic dissection, pulmonary edema, and then unstable angina or a flat out like MI or stroke. So some pretty serious things that are going on right there. And that's why we call that hypertensive emergency. So send those people to ED. I'm not going to talk about treatment here because I'm sure I'll probably do that in a different podcast, but that's the difference for those people. Oh, I guess there's a secret category. Sorry, guys. There's a secret category called malignant hypertension. And I don't actually know if the new teachings make a distinction of this. I saw this written in some places and other places didn't even mention it, but malignant hypertension is the presence of papilledema. So you need to go see that on the eye exam. So this is why we look at eye exams, apparently. Apparently it's probably only done on the boards because I never did that in the ED, but who knows? Maybe that was just me. All right, so quick sidebar there. So now that we've diagnosed somebody with hypertension or elevated, right? Because that's that's the second category, normal, elevated, stage one or stage two. Do you remember what the numbers were? Under 120, 120, 130, 140 for systolic. And then you only needed two numbers for diastolic, 80 or 90. All right, great. So I've diagnosed elevated or actual hypertension. Now what do I do? So what are we telling these people to do? Well, guess what? Absolutely. Everybody gets lifestyle changes. What do I mean by that? Weight loss, specifically weight loss. And also one of the best ways to do that is with this thing called the DASH diet. I'm going to embarrass myself by admitting that I had no idea what DASH stood for. So I looked it up, guys, and let me save you the embarrassment of me not knowing, not having known what it was. Oh my God. And I didn't even write it down and I've totally forgotten it. Oh my gosh. Hold on. And I found it. Really wish I had the editing ability to insert the Jeopardy song right there. Would have been perfect, but I'm not that fancy. All right. So DASH diet stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension. So no wonder why we tell everybody with formally diagnosed hypertension to go on the DASH diet, because it was literally designed for them. So there you go. Pearl. Put your people on the DASH diet, tell them to decrease sodium, tell them to reduce their alcohol intake. I mean, all the fun things. No more fun anymore. No more sodium, no more alcohol. And they need to start exercising. Specifically, if it's moderate intensity, meaning you shouldn't be able to just like talk through. This is how my preceptor talked about it. He said you shouldn't be able to talk through it without some significant panting and breaks. So moderate intensity exercise 5 times a week by 30 minutes, and biking and like swimming and rowing were some of his favorite things to tell these people, because I guess everybody's got knee problems. So nobody likes running when you've got knee problems. And then if you, instead of doing moderate intensity activity, if you actually did vigorous intensity, you only have to do it 3 times a week. So I'm looking at you, CrossFitters. 3 times a week, apparently, all you really need to be doing if you've got hypertension. So score one for you. Okay, so everybody gets lifestyle changes. What about the second category? What happens if somebody's got elevated? What specifically do they need to do? Turns out, lifestyle only. And then they have to come back and see you in 3 to 6 months to see if their lifestyle only interventions have helped. Okay, next, stage one. Stage one, to remind us all, starts at 130 or diastolic at 80. And turns out these people may not actually need medication. And this is tricky, so stay with me on this one. So your patient is at 135 over 85, right? Nice round numbers, over 130 over 80. Do they need medication? Well, what we need to do is calculate the ASCVD risk for them. And this is the atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk. And this little risk calculator, it helps predict the 10-year risk of having an atherosclerotic cardiovascular event. And if you do the calculation for the ASCVD, and you don't have to do it in your head, there's calculators all over the interwebs. Most people know MDCalc. So if their ASCVD risk is greater than 10%, then you can start the medication. So they may not need the meds, but if their ASCVD is greater than 10%, then it's okay to start the medicine. And basically what we're trying to avoid here, right? So, I mean, I keep using this word, atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. Like what events am I talking about, right? These are just jargon for your patients. Specifically, we are trying to avoid a first non-fatal heart attack. So just having a heart attack, but you survived it, but it was still a heart attack. So that's not good. We're trying to prevent a non-fatal MI. We're trying to prevent the onset of coronary heart disease. And we're trying to prevent either a fatal or a non-fatal stroke. I don't think that's going to be on the boards, but just it helps me figure out how to process this kind of information, because it's just gobbledygook until I look it up, because that's how my brain works. I actually need to know how the thing works before I can even have a chance at remembering it. So the ASCVD risk, if it's greater than 10% in your stage one hypertension people, they may not mean they, or they, then you can start the medication if it's over than 10%. And then just for our own edification, the components of this ASCVD calculator include things like patient's race, their sex, their age, their total cholesterol, and their HDL. So we're going to get to that in just a minute. Their systolic blood pressure, whether or not they're already on a hypertension medication, whether or not they're diabetes, and whether or not they smoke. So those are just the components of the ASCVD risk calculator. Again, just so that we know what we're talking about. All right, so still on stage one. So they're over 130 or 80. We're going to calculate the ASCVD risk. If it's greater than 10%, start some medication. Now, there is an immediate don't pass go, go directly to medication jail. And that is if these patients have type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, or they already have known cardiovascular disease. So like they've already had an MI, maybe they've already had a stroke. So if you're in stage one hypertension, but you have one of those three things, don't pass go, go straight to medication jail. You need to start meds right away. And then you need to check these people back in 1 month. If at 1 month they're still not at goal, and we'll get to hear what goal is in a minute, but if their hypertension is still uncontrolled in a month, you either increase the dose or you can even add a second medication. That's probably getting a little weedsy here, but that's how I do things sometimes. Essentially, you're going to follow these people every month until you get down to goal. All right, so that was stage one hypertension. Stage two hypertension, right? What are our numbers? Under 120, 120, 130, 140. So these are your 140s and 90s or above. And the way that I think of, the way that I remember this is stage two hypertension, you automatically get on two medications. So stage two, automatically start two different classes of hypertension medicines, and then they actually have the same recheck schedule. So do it monthly until you meet their goal. Now, what's goal? Turns out, as a ton of things in medicine, we actually have new goals for hypertension. Absolutely everybody gets under 130 over 80. That's for everyone. And that's different because they used to break it up based on patients' comorbidities, but this was a new update. So everybody wants to get goal blood pressure under 130 over 80, doesn't matter on their comorbidities. And this was based on this study called the SPRINT study, which I don't normally look up stuff, but I got this huge handout from this cardiologist in my hospital medicine rotation, and I read the whole damn thing, and it was actually pretty interesting. So this study found that there were lower rates of both fatal and non-fatal stroke and heart attacks that happened when people's systolic blood pressure were between 120 and 124, which is like super tight control of blood pressure. I mean, super, super tight. So 120 to 124 is actually ideal, but the formal guidelines just say, just get yourself below 130 over 80 and we'll be happy with that. So new goal, 130 over 80. All right. So that is who are we starting medications in? Next question, what kind of medications should you start? So somebody's got hypertension, what kind of meds are you going to start? And this also gets, this is also clear as mud. And there's even an algorithm, and it was super complicated when my professors showed it to us in class, but I think I've kind of broken it down. So let me try to simplify this as best I can. So you've got three main options for first-line medications for hypertension. You've got your hydrochlorothiazides, your calcium channel blockers, and your ACEs slash ARBs. So I put ACEs and ARBs in one category because essentially they're the same thing, except the way we were taught was that ARBs carry less of the cough. So really, we should just be using those. All right, so three main options, and that is for your non-Black patients. So your non-Black patients, hydrochlorothiazide, calcium channel blockers, ACEs and ARBs. And they split that up because in our African-American populations, you actually only have two choices because they found that the ACEs and the ARBs are actually not as effective for the African-American folks. So African-American folks start that, try either a thiazide or the calcium channel block for them. So that's kind of a blanket statement there, right? You've got those three choices and you can pick one based on essentially a patient race. And then they get a little bit pickier because in order to help you figure out, well, which one of those two or three should I start? Essentially, the next thing is look at the patient's comorbidities. So if the patient has kidney, like chronic kidney disease or CHF or diabetes, you might want to protect their kidneys a little bit better for them. Well, what of those three medications that I just said is actually like kidney and heart protective? It's the ACEs and ARBs. So that's essentially how you use what are my patient's other comorbidities to direct which of those few medications you're going to use. So chronic kidney disease, CHF or diabetes, try the ACE or the ARB. What are the side effects? We've got the classic dry bradykinin cough, and I call it the bradykinin cough because I feel like any test that I've ever formally sat through has always asked, like, what is the cause of the dry cough that's associated with lisinopril? So buzzword, bradykinin. So that's the main side effect that you can get with ACEs, and a little bit less with ARBs. But the other buzzword, scary word for ACEs and ARBs is angioedema. And then also put in your brains that ACEs and ARBs are not for pregnant or breastfeeding ladies. So there's your ACEs and ARBs. Okay. Next comorbidity. What if somebody's got heart troubles like AFib? Well, what's a medication that we can use for like rate and rhythm control? Calcium channel blockers. Specifically, most people reach for the amlodipine. And that one carries with it a pretty standard side effect, super classic for lower extremity edema. So amlodipine, one of your calcium channel blockers, super known side effect of lower extremity edema. And then remember also that calcium channel blocker is something that we can use in our African-American patients. Next up, what about if somebody's got osteoporosis, kidney stones, or again, in our African-American population, we can try the thiazides. So hydrochlorothiazide would be good for people, again, osteoporosis, kidney stones, or our African-American folks. What are the side effects of thiazides? Super common one is hypo kalemia. So low potassium, hypokalemia goes with thiazides. And then just to make it annoying, you actually can get hyperglycemia. So again, we're talking about thiazides here. Super common hypokalemia, which I always remember that for whatever weird reason, but I never remember that it can increase glucose. So what's a patient population that you might not want to use thiazides in? If we're worried about glucose in people, obviously I'm talking about your type 2 diabetics. So maybe don't use it for your type 2 diabetics. Along that same vein, thiazides also increase uric acid. So what disease am I talking about when I'm saying, ooh, be worried about your uric acid people? Gout patients. So thiazides may not be that great for type 2 diabetics and for your gout patients. And also another pearl, another buzzword, we don't use these in kidney disease. There's actually another second line medication that we'd use in kidney disease. And we're going to get to that in a quick bit. Actually, like right now. So those were our first line medications. Hydrochlorothiazides, calcium channel blockers, ACEs and ARBs. Those are your three choices. If you are treating an African American patient, stick with either the calcium channel blocker or the hydrochlorothiazide. All right, second line of medications. What if your patient has BPH? Well, that's your good old alpha blockers or prazosin. Prazosin? I don't know. I should have looked that one up. Sorry, guys. So prazosin, good for your BPH people. And then let's see, what about, somebody else with other heart issues. I know we already kind of talked about if they've got AFib, you can use a calcium channel blocker. But another option for AFib or, coronary artery disease in general is beta blockers. Again, not second line, right? Beta blockers, not second line. Put that in your brain. But certainly something that you consider again for AFib or coronary artery disease. And now we finally got to the chronic kidney disease people. What's the medication that we want to use? We definitely want to avoid the thiazides, but medication of choice for chronic kidney disease people, specifically if their creatinine clearance is less than 30, you want to use a loop diuretic. So basically your Lasix, i.e. furosemide, or bumetanide. That's another one that I kind of hear every now and then, but most commonly everybody thinks of Lasix. So use your Lasix in your chronic kidney disease people. And I'm pretty sure you can even use it in AKI. I'm pretty sure I use that for a handful of folks when they were in the hospital. Okay, so that's medicines for hypertension. And finishing up the hypertension talk just now, I've got a bonus question for you. What age do we start screening annually for blood pressure? What age do we start screening annually for blood pressure? And maybe this is a terrible question, but I wanted to put it in here because it blew my mind. But then I remember like, oh yeah, I guess I kind of remember learning about that. Officially, according to the 2017 AAP guidelines, age 3, little itty bitty toddlers, age 3, were starting to screen annually for blood pressure. Now, I saw it written in other places that we don't need to start screening for blood pressure until age 20. So actually that was kind of a terrible question, but I do remember in our pediatrics that it was said that you start screening at age 3. Maybe that's only if there's like a family history of it, or I don't know, maybe if they're overweight already by age 3. But anyway, one of the resources that I found said age 3. Okay, that's going to wrap up hypertension. Next up, lipid disorders. Man, I hope you guys like the little instrumental musical interludes that I have the ability to put in here. I find them highly amusing, and I hope you guys do too. So sorry, but I'm gonna keep using them because I think they're really, really, really funny. I'm actually gonna stop here because this is getting a little out of control, and I haven't even gotten into the for two out of the three things that I really wanted to cover. And that's because they're really big topics. They're a huge part of primary medicine, which is why I saw them all the time. People, they're just so, so, so prevalent. So I'm going to stop here at hypertension. And before I do, I want to make a point of clarification that I about beta blockers. I said incorrectly a couple times that they were not second line. That's totally false. That's the only thing that they are. Beta blockers are only second line for hypertension. So sorry about that. I'll say it again. Beta blockers are only considered second line for hypertension. They're a terrible, by and large, hypertension medication. And we need to use them as a second line medicine only when people are coming in with other heart arrhythmias, like an AFib, for instance. So point of clarification on that one. So that'll do it for this episode. We've done a lot of hard work. Hypertension is a bear, and I actually should have gotten into some of the side effect of the medications a little bit more. So it's crazy to think that there's actually more that we could have covered on hypertension, but I think that was a pretty good smattering and we've done a good job. So let's call it a day. I will try to bring us, I'll actually try to split the hyperlipidemia and type 2 diabetes probably into their own little mini episodes so that they're a little bit easier to break apart and consume. I'll hope to try to get those out pretty quickly, mainly because I would like to go over that before I sit for my boards next week. But I also want to make sure that I am covering urgent care for us and talk about some of the more HENT things that came through the door. Again, because everybody hates the CENTAUR criteria, but I know it now. And so I'm going to share it with you. And that's going to be my teaser to get you to check in next time. So thanks for sticking around with me this time. And see you on the next episode.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.